Making a return visit to the show is our friend Mike Oswald. Mike has written a fantastic book called Your Guide to the National Parks. First, Mike, hi. How are you? Thanks for being here.
Oh, I'm fantastic, Bill. Thanks for having me. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing really well. I'm not kidding when I say this. I love when I find a book that is the definitive book on a certain topic. You know, I'm a fan of books, and I know it's always nice to have a couple of books on any given subject, but I don't know how anybody could possibly put together a book that has more information about national parks and more stunning photography than the book you've done, Your Guide to National Parks. Well done, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. That's extremely flattering.
I mean it. It really, you know, you and I spoke about a year ago, and I looked at it then, and in preparation for tonight's talk, I went through the book, and I just said, I don't think Mike's missed a single thing. As you go back and look through the book, is there something you would have done differently?
There's a fair amount. I mean, it's kind of, you get yourself in a situation where you want to know what's too big. It's already at 704 pages, and, you know, more pictures are always better. More camping information would have been better, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, everything's in there for a reason. I think it's, like you said, it is pretty comprehensive and the definitive tome for the national parks as a whole.
It is. It's filled to the brim with all kinds of things, and it has pictures of really scary bats.
You got to squeeze something scary in there.
Yeah, you do.
Some bats, something like that.
Well, you talk about the cave tours, and I know some national parks have them. And one of my fears, you know, I've never been on a cave tour. At some point, I'm certainly going to do it. But one of my fears is that something like a bat just comes out of nowhere and just takes a bite out of me. That could never happen, though, could it?
I mean, they've got that sonar working for them. You can just stand there and let them fly all around you. They'll miss you.
Have you, in any of your tours, in any of your travels at any of the national parks, have you come across some sort of an animal or a beast that even you went, oh, I don't want to tangle with that thing?
Well, I mean, a lot of them you don't want to tangle with. I did, hiking down a trail, I saw a little baby grizzly, a cub, and didn't see the mother. And that worried me a little bit because that's where you don't want to be. You never want to be between a grizzly and its cub. So, and I was trying to figure out where the last time I saw a human being was, and it was like 3 miles down trail, a couple guys with a chainsaw, and I'm like, oh, man, if something happens, I'm a goner.
Well, the fear...
But I just put my head down, kept on hiking, and nothing happened.
Is the fear there that the mother won't understand that you're there to research a book? You know, the one thing that grizzlies never seem to get in their thick skulls is some of us are in certain places to research books. So your fear would be they think I'm going to try to steal the baby. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, you're right. They should know better, but I don't know. Far be it from me to just try to do my work in their home and just leave me be. But
yeah.
Every once in a while they want a meal too.
I guess they're selfish, but I understand it. Let's talk about you, Mike. Before the book, before you put together this book, you were an engineer. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. And what was that transition like? What were you doing that made you decide, hey, I'm an engineer and I've been doing this for a while, but I got to do something else? What went on?
Oh, man, it's probably a whole lot of stupidity.
Really?
I'm not sure. I mean, I was sitting in a cubicle, and I didn't like that so much. You know, I saw a whole lot of the greedy side and the selfish side of corporate America. And just kind of like, oh, this isn't for me. And I was looking for something more emotional and rewarding. So this actually isn't even anywhere near what I thought I was going to do. I thought I was going to go work for Doctors Without Borders and do that, something relatively safe, I guess would be the word.
Yeah.
And you'd have a salary and things would be taken care of for you. But that didn't work out. And next thing I know, I thought I was going to go to South America. That didn't work out. I went there, but that... Long story, but I came back, and then while I was having surgery, I ended up hatching this plan to go to the parks and make a guidebook because I'd gone to a few, taking my parents on a trip out west, and I didn't think National Geographic was quite as good as it could be.
Yeah,
well, something better.
Think about that, because we all grew up looking through National Geographic, and at the time, they seemed to be. I use the word definitive to describe your book. At the time, they were kind of the state of the art when it came to travel and what's what in and around the globe, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with their book. It's good, but it's almost for more road-bound tourists. They drive you into the park and drive you out, and you stop at a few places. And I'm like, there's so much more to these. There's so much going on, like different activities you've been doing beyond hiking and camping, and just wanted to make the book for everybody.
Had you always been something of a traveler and an explorer, Mike?
I grew up on a farm, so I had a whole lot of free rein in terms of what I could do. You could go, if I went straight east on the farmland, you'd run into a fence by the interstate, mm-hmm. and if it went the other way, you'd run into another road. But in between 70 acres with a little creek and pond, and put a BB gun in my hands and just let me wander around.
See, now, to me, a guidebook of that farm sounds like an interesting read. I'd buy that book if you want to write that
book. I might have some old maps that I drew laying around here.
So at some point, you said to yourself, you know, you went through a couple of different career changes and life changes, and this book came to you. Did you have to sell this idea to a publisher or to money people? How'd you raise the money to tour? Because you had to go all over the country to pull this off. How did that happen?
Yeah, the I guess you call it, for lack of a better word, research phase. That was all done with my savings. I had enough money saved up to do something. Like I said, I wasn't sure what it was yet, but I knew I was going to cut myself off from all the benefits of a normal working job. And just go on it on my own. And so the research was handled, and then I sat down and put the book together. That took 2 years of just getting up in the morning, walking over to my computer in an adjacent room, and then sitting down and going back to bed. So 2 years after that, I had the book, and I did the whole thing in Adobe InDesign, which is like the industry standard for publishing. And I realized that I had a PDF. I didn't really need a publisher. My editor went through the whole thing, which was a high school friend. And I just started calling printers and calling distributors. So I got a printer and a distributor, and my parents were nice enough to take a loan out on the farm, on the old farm.
Wow.
So they backed me. They had, I don't know how I convinced them that this was going to work, but they believed in enough of me to take a small business loan out on the farm. Because I tried doing that on my own. I went into the bank several times kind of doing that George Costanza thing where you wear him down, wear him down, wear him down.
Yeah.
But they're like, we don't want your scooter. We don't want your old car. You've got no collateral. You've got no tax returns. We're not giving you any money.
So, Mike, if any of us have a book idea in our heads, are your mom and dad still taking pitch ideas? Can I call them up and tell them about ideas that I've had?
Yeah, how about we put their phone number and email address out there on the radio waves and see if he calls again.
The next 6 weeks would be them just their phone ringing off the hook. You'd never hear from them. I mean, you'd never hear the end of this from them. You know that, right?
That might be fun, actually. Hearing other people's pitches on what they want to write about or what they want money for.
I like it. I think it's the beginning of an empire. So as you're coming up with this, the structure of this, realizing I'm going to have to tour for a couple of years, I'm going to have to get all my thoughts down, somebody's going to have to edit this. As you're doing all this, what did you think would be the biggest challenge, Mike?
Honestly, just sticking with it, because there are a lot of days when I'm just like, oh, man, this isn't going to work. It was an emotional roller coaster for me, and I called myself Menopausal Mike for a long time. Some days I was just so excited and just like, yes, this is going to be great. And then other days, if I spent the whole day like staring at the wall and never didn't make a single page all day, I'm like, oh, God, I should just pull the plug and get a job.
But yeah, you can say that, though. But when you look at the finished product, like you said, it's 700 pages, and it's so full of facts that just by touching the book, I learn things about parks. I don't even have to read it. I just touch it, and I learn things. You have to be thrilled with what you've pulled off, are you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, it was pretty nerve-wracking the whole time, just not knowing what was going to happen. But, yeah, when I was finished and when I saw it on, like, a Barnes & Noble shelf, that's when it really sunk in, and I really felt good about things. I'm like, oh, this might work out after all.
That's got to be one of the biggest thrills, is to just walk into a bookstore. And I know they're getting harder and harder to find, and actually you should write a guide to finding bookstores. That should be your next idea. But when you walk into a bookstore and you're in the bookstore and you're looking and you're going, wow, there's Shakespeare over there and there's Chaucer over there and there's my book over there. That's got to make your heart beat really fast.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And I've been doing like some presentations places, and one of the best experiences is this lady who came up to me. She's like, "Oh my God, that's my book you're sitting there." And I don't like talking about being the person who made it or anything. So I just kind of sat there. I was doing a signing at a camping RV show.
Yeah,
thought I was somebody from this company, and she's like, "I love this book." She's like, "I have the National Geographic book. Somebody, one of my friends told me to get rid of it. Use this one." She's like, so immediately I threw it away, and she's like, "This book's taking me everywhere." I'm like, "Well, thank you. I'm flattered." She's like, "Flattered?" She's like, "Who are you?" And I'm like, I'm the guy who wrote it.
better than National Geographic, Mike. And the only thing that's missing, honestly, the only thing I think National Geographic has you beat on is I've been all through 700 pages of your book, not a single photograph of a naked pygmy. Something's wrong. You gotta include that.
Shoot. I must have been setting up my tripod in the wrong spot.
Nah, that's going to happen. All right, Mike Oswald is my guest. He is the author of Your Guide to National Parks. I'm telling you, if you're a fan, even if you're not a fan of this sort of thing, this book is going to dazzle you. Unbelievable photographs, incredible facts about national parks all over the country. We'll take another look at it with Mike in just a little bit. You can jump in if you like, 312-981-7200 on the phones, 24/7/20 on the texts. We'll pick this up in a little bit. It's WGN. My guest has written a phenomenal book. It's called Your Guide to the National Parks. Mike Oswald is here with us. Mike, I'm going to make a comparison that's going to sound really silly at first and probably will be at the end, but let me make it anyway. There's a parable from a long time ago about seven blind men who come across an elephant, and each one of the blind men touches a different part of an elephant, and they all get very different ideas of what the elephant looks like because one of them touches the trunk and one of them touches a leg and one of them touches an ear. I always, as I'm looking through your book, I think that about this country, about the United States, that depending on where in the United States you are, you would get a very specific idea of what this country is like or looks like. That's how vast this place is. That's how amazing this place is. The book captures it beautifully, but depending on where you are, you're going to get a very different impression of what the topography and the geography of a certain state or city is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an excellent way to put it. It's really interesting when you meet people from other countries and they're visiting here. One of the first things they say, they're like, USA is really big.
Yep.
Yeah, because they get sick of driving from place to place, and they get all confused with the different geography, weather, everything changes from one place to another.
You know, because in Europe, you can get in a car and drive to five different countries in an hour. It's no big deal. But here in the United States, Texas alone, you could spend a month in Texas.
Oh, God, don't remind me. That wasn't one of my most enjoyable drives.
Is that it? But be honest, when you're in Texas, you just go, this is like being in infinity. When I'm in Texas, there's no end.
Yeah, I think that's why they have to keep reminding you not to mess with Texas, because you just get angry while you're sitting there pulling on the steering wheel.
As you envision this, did you think to yourself, I'd be better off having a traveling companion or companions, or was this always designed to be just you?
Oh, for sure it would have been better with a companion. And I got that question brought up to me all the time. I'm like, if you can find someone who's willing to spend hundreds of nights in a tent or in a four-door hatchback car, introduce me. Because I'd like to meet this person, and we'd go on our merry way. But it's really hard to say, though, because I don't know if I would have gotten as much done, too. You probably kind of focus on the fun more than when you're with somebody else and rather than getting stuff done.
Well, I just think from a sanity standpoint, because as you pointed out, you did this. This was a 2-year trek, correct?
Yeah. It was like 50,000-mile road trip.
Wow! All by car? You had to fly like to Hawaii and stuff.
Yes, there was a little bit of flying.
Yeah, but all by car. The same car? Did the same car make the whole trip?
The same car. I just sold it this past week to a kid in Waukesha.
Oh, was that impossible for you?
It was pretty emotional, actually. I handled it better than I expected, but once it was gone, it set in. I'm like, oh. Well, memories and that thing. The kid liked it, that it was the picture of this car's in this book. I'm like, yeah, take a copy. You can show your friends.
I imagine, though, at some point, your car became like Wilson the Volleyball in Castaway, where it's your only companion at some point, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. I think my sanity stuck with me for the most part. Every once in a while, friends would come out, check up on me, and meet me at a park or in a city, and we'd hang out. But yeah, you're probably right. I'm trying to make myself look better than I was. I probably did lose it a little bit, and just me and my car. I did have a little goat ornament riding shotgun. So yeah, it wasn't too normal.
Well, think about it for anybody, and I know that it wasn't like you were in solitary confinement. I mean, you were traveling all over the country. You were seeing beautiful things. But at some point, because I used to do stand-up, and there were days where I'd be by myself for 2 or 3 days at a time, and I'd start to question things. You know, after 2 or 3 days, I can't imagine 2 years of doing that.
Yeah, I don't know. I find it's almost like a vacation for me in itself, just sitting in these places with a journal, writing stuff down. I really enjoy that for whatever reason.
Do me a favor. I know I asked you this last time, but I don't remember the answer. What qualifies something as a national park? How do they determine what is and what is not a national park?
National parks are established by Congress. So some politician brings it up, congressman or senator, and makes a bill, sends it to the president, they approve it, send it to the president signs it, and then you get yourself a park.
So they nominate it, essentially, right? Somebody will say, they'll see something and they'll say, I can't believe that's not a national park. We need to nominate it. It's that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, now it's kind of, back in the day, before there were parks, that's basically the way it was. Like, and more to protect them, too, because they're either logging or in the Everglades situation where water was being diverted, they had to protect them. But now it's basically, they're all federal lands. They're like national monuments being converted to national parks. Their national recreation area would be converted to a park. Like just, my book's actually obsolete already because there are 59 national parks. And in January, President Obama signed a bill that got put on his desk to create Pinnacles National Park in California, just south of San Francisco. So that's the 59th national park now.
So the number can change. Can the number only be increased? They can never take the status away from something that exists as a national park, can they?
They actually have turned a few back into the Platt National Park in Oklahoma, and there's another one that was in one of the Dakotas that they revoked the park status because it's kind of these congressmen or senators, they get pressure from their states and they want a park. They know that they're hot for tourism and bring dollars to their states. So they look around every corner of their state trying to find something. In Oklahoma, they're like, well, I'll take this place. And then people from the government actually went out there like, that's not a park. and then they took it away. Same thing with the Dakota one.
You call this a national park? This? Come on. This is an embarrassment. That's terrible. That's awful. All right, do me a favor. We're going to break for news, and when we return, more talk about a fun book, a very I don't even know what the right word is. It's not only the most definitive book on national parks. I don't know that they can ever do a better one. That's what it is. It's Your Guide to National Parks. The author is Michael Oswald. He's our guest, so we'll do the news, and then we'll continue. Mike, stay where you are, all right?
You got it.
All right, it's WGN. We are talking about a stunning book that you can get for yourself, Your Guide to the National Parks. The author, Mike Oswald, is here with us talking about the book. I'm telling you, as you page through it, and I've been doing it, it's my second time now. I'm stunned by the majesty of the national parks all over the country. Mike, you're a pretty good, in addition to being a great author, you're a pretty good photographer. You realize that, don't you?
Honestly, I think most of the credit goes to the scenery. I'm mainly a point-and-shoot guy. I'm starting to learn more about what I'm doing, but most of them just kind of right place, right time. I wake up early and stay up till sunset, so that's kind of the key, is get the early and late light.
I have many, many questions from people who have texted them in. I'll read you a couple of them. 773 asks you this question. How many state parks are there in Illinois, and which ones do you recommend?
Ooh, state parks, I don't know. You guys don't have any national...
We have no national parks, right?
No. The whole kind of center of the country is a little bit barren of national parks. That's what I was thinking while I sat back here. Sully's Hill was the other one that revoked its parks, had its park status revoked, and I'm like, a senator should have turned to somebody and be like, a hill? It's just a hill?
That's all it is?
We're not going to make that a national park. but yeah, I don't know your state parks well. I don't know if I've even ever been to one.
Well, one of the ones that gets so much attention is Starved Rock, right, here in Illinois. So what would prevent somebody here, a politician, from saying, hey, people love it as a state park, let's make it a national park? What's that process like?
I'd imagine it's just the same. They'd have to get political backing and have the state turn it over to the federal government, and it could happen as long as it just gets on paper and then signed by the president.
That's the process. Which national parks are there located in the Midwest? There's only a handful, huh?
Yeah, just a few. You got you mentioned the cave tours earlier, and in Kentucky, Mammoth Cave is there, which is the largest cave in the world. It's a really neat place. And like you mentioned, going through the darkness and finding bats, there's a little tight squeeze called Batman's Misery. I lost the belt loop on my pants there. I was trying to squeeze through, and I'm just a regular sized guy. So you get yourself some tight jams crawling through the cave. And then
now they're going to have to close that. If Americans keep getting larger and larger, that park will be closed because somebody's going to get wedged in.
If you come in there, at least for me, there's this little old lady who comes around with a tape measure. I'm like, what are you doing? She's like, we got to measure you up, shoulders and waist. I'm like,
okay. Wow.
And then in Michigan, in the UP, there's Isle Royale National Park, which is in Lake Superior, closer to Canada. It's quite close to Canada, actually. I couldn't swim across, but moose did. They made the journey to get onto the island, so you can find moose on Isle Royale.
Oh, nice.
In Minnesota, there's Voyageurs National Park, which is kind of by the Boundary Waters.
And that's it. That's pretty much all we've got in the Midwest, isn't it?
For the most part, you can go over in Ohio. There's Cuyahoga Valley, which is kind of it's a strange park between Akron and
where else?
Cleveland. Akron.
Oh, from Cleveland, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just there's a ski hill there and a bunch of little shops and some old kind of cultural things. It's not like when you think parks, you always think out west for the most part. So it is kind of tough for a Midwesterner. Most of the people that I know around in the Midwest, they're heading to Yellowstone and to Glacier.
Yeah.
And
to get into all national parks, is there always a fee and like additional like camping fees and stuff? National parks aren't free, right? You pay a little bit to visit them, don't you?
Yeah, for the most part, there are fee areas and all the front country campgrounds have fees. Some of the back country campgrounds have fees now too. But you can get a America's Beautiful Pass. If you're a senior, it's a great deal. It's $10 once you're 62, and then that's a lifetime pass for all the fee areas, and that's not even inclusive of all the National Park Service units. So you've got the monuments, the memorials, the war sites, and everything. Anywhere they charge a fee, you get in for free.
And that kicks in at age, you said 62, huh?
Age 62, yep. Otherwise, it's $80 for a year, and there are other ways to circumvent the fees. You can do volunteering so many hours, and then you get a free pass for a year. And there are veterans passes and disabled citizens passes.
What about for you, a guy who is such an advocate of the parks and has written this book? Do they let you in for free, or do even you have to pay?
I pay.
You do pay.
I don't know how much they. I was just I wintered in Hawaii to start working on the next book. I'm going to do a Hawaii guidebook.
And oh, nice.
Some of the things I do there, like I was staring at the active volcano Pu'o'o on the Big Island, and while I'm looking at it, I got on my phone to call a friend, letting them know I was thinking about doing something stupid because you've got all these signs, do not go further. And I'm like, well, they've got webcams up there. You got to go a little further, don't you? To take a look. When I put my phone down, this guy, Australian guy, is coming out of the jungle. And I'm like, do you want to go to the top of that volcano? He's like, do I ever? And so we go tripping up the volcano to take a look inside.
That's either
probably shouldn't say on, I guess.
No, you shouldn't say. But
I should have thought about that a little more.
You know how they always say there's a fine line between being really really brave and really really stupid. I'm not sure which one that is. That's one or the other, or maybe both.
Yeah, I don't know. Our whole rationale is these webcams are up there and other scientific equipment. So, like, people will go up there, and they have a geologist trail going up the side. So, like, nah. We weren't satisfied with just looking at the webcams. Like, we want to see this in person, not at our computer.
Let's get a call in or two. Bob's been on hold for a little bit. Bob, hi. You're on the line with Mike Oswald, the author of Your Guide to National Parks. Go ahead.
Hey, Mike. Hi, Bill. I have one national, it's a national forest. It's called Schwanigan National Forest in Wisconsin.
Yep.
That has an actual falls in that place. Now, what's the difference between a national park and a national forest?
It's just the designation. So national parks are generally, they have better facilities, they're better roads. Everything's more well-established, and they're more heavily trafficked. I know out east when you get into some of the national forests, they don't have a lot of national parks either, and the national forests are really busy. But check Chipwamagon, what you're talking about?
It's an Indian name, Schwamigan, C-H-A-U something or other. It's Schwamigan.
I know that one you're talking about, but it's just less facilities, less they don't have as many much headcount. So basically, the only employees that are there are watching for fires and just kind of monitoring this thing. They aren't leading tours.
It's really nice because they have a waterfall there and stuff, and we kind of camped underneath the waterfall and stuff and climbed
the area there.
And yeah, absolutely.
It's a really nice national forest. If anybody is interested. It's up where they make Leinen Kugel beer up there.
Oh,
so,
delicious.
Not only can you will go in the national forest, but you can drink as well.
That's a winning combination.
Which is nice. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Bob, thanks
you guys
so much.
Have a great night. Bob, thanks.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You know, it's funny. Every time I see a waterfall in a movie or a television show, I always say to myself, I want to see more of those in real life. I've seen them in Hawaii, but that's about it. But you've seen quite a few of them, Mike, because I'm going through the book. There's a couple of waterfalls.
Yeah. Again, and most of them are out west when you get into the Rockies or into Yosemite Valley and the High Sierra. I think the two highest waterfalls in North America are in Yosemite National Park, Sentinel and Yosemite Falls.
And is this the sort of thing, do national parks go on in other countries, or is that just something that America has made its own?
Oh, it started here in the U.S., but national parks are everywhere now. It's a extremely popular thing it sparks tourism in all these other countries, even though Europe and a lot of Central America and even the Far East, they had a pretty good tourism industry going. But yeah, national parks are extremely popular, just preserving and the ecotourism thing.
I had mentioned earlier the idea of camping in some. You can't camp in all of them, right? There's just a set number that they'll allow you to camp in them, right?
Almost all of them you can camp in. There are only a very few where you can't. Cuyahoga Valley is one where they only have they only allow camping to bikers and hike through camping. So they have a couple of small sites. I think it's maybe 6 sites on this trail. So if you get there by non-motorized power, you can spend the night. But other than that, you're not camping there.
Are there bike trails set up in most of them?
Not so much. Most of the trails actually don't allow bicycles, but many of them do have nice bike trails and nice horse trails, but mostly it's hiking-centric.
That's interesting to me, because I would think there's a couple that go a little bit out of their way to do it, but not many, huh?
Yeah, not a whole lot.
What about a Segway? I would like to do a Segway through all the parks. Would they allow that?
I'm the guy bending the rules here, going to look at volcanoes. I can't see why you can't take a Segway through.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Segway up to the top of Mount Whitney or Mount McKinley.
Wouldn't that be a magical time? That would be all right. And do they limit the time you're allowed in? Like if you say to them, I'm going to camp indefinitely, I may be here for a few days, I may be here for a few months, do they allow that kind of thing? Or is it a set amount of time that you're allowed in on most of them?
It's usually 7 days out of 30, and then maybe 30 days out of a year for each campsite, but it's different from all the parks, and I have no idea how they pick these numbers. I think a lot of it has to do with popularity to get more people into the park, because some of these you have to be online, like booking your campsites or booking your hotel reservations like the day they become available, when it's popular places like Glacier or Yosemite.
What do you say to people? You know, one of the reasons we had you on is, you know, it's the middle of June. This is the time when many people are starting to take family vacations. I know for a lot of people's kids, if you said you have an option here, we can go to a national park, we can go to an amusement park, a lot of them would probably pick an amusement park. But what do you say to that? How do you convince them that this is not a bad option?
Oh, man, I think it's you just get out. You have to really experience it for yourself. Even looking at the pictures are fantastic, but it doesn't really compare to being there yourself. And just like camping, it's a whole family experience, sitting around a campfire, hiking these trails, seeing wildlife. Again, Mickey Mouse and roller coasters are fun too, but I think it can kind of help shape your children's lives too, to get them more outdoors. Like, that's one of the things I've done a lot of presentations around the area. And I always talk about how these sites are irreplaceable and priceless, where we kind of are, as a society, we focus on man-made things that
sure.
are completely replaceable and bought with money, which is fine, too, but kind of think about the other things, too. Think about nature a little more.
And I had asked you this last time, but just quickly reiterate it. I'm not a camping person. I like a more luxurious hotel stay over a campsite. Some of them do have hotels in them, don't they?
Yeah, this is one of the big defining characteristics between places like national monuments and national forests, too. There are lodges in most of these parks, and really nice lodges where you have all the luxuries of home, and they do their best to make them blend in or to match the scenery and beauty and majesty. So, yeah, almost any, especially all the popular parks, the big name brand parks, Grand Canyon, Yosemite, Glacier, Grand Teton, you'll find lodges at them. Again, hard to get in at some of them, but you'll have your shower. You'll have great meals. Some of them are extremely fancy, like the Awani in Yosemite and El Tovar. I think we tried to get that name last time. We talked at Grand Canyon, Jenny Lake Lodge at Grand Teton. There are some really fine lodging and fine dining experiences to be had in the parks, too.
So it's not as, I mean, it can be a rustic thing if you want it to be, but it doesn't have to be. You can lift it up a little bit. You can have some nice amenities.
You can really pick what you want to.
Yeah.
And all the, like, you realize how many tourists are coming through these places when you come to the gateway towns, too, because you'll find all the chain hotels, too, at every gateway. So you can always stay outside the park, too, and a few bucks.
Okay. My guest again, Mike Oswald, the author of Your Guide to the National Parks. We'll come back and talk a little bit more. If you've sent me a question that I've not asked yet, be patient. I'll get to it in just a little bit. It's Bill Left with you on WGN. My guest is Mike Oswald. Mike has put together a magnificent book, Your Guide to the National Parks. As full of facts as you can possibly imagine in a book. Every single page just has all the information about everything you'd ever want to know about every national park here in the country. And like I said, the photography is stunning, too. Mike, 2 years it took you. Did you think at the very beginning that it would take you that long? Did you map it out and say to yourself, this looks to be a 2-year project, or did that just happen the way it happened?
That just happened the way it actually, so it was 2 years putting the book together and 2 years doing the research. I thought it'd be 1 and 1, so I thought it'd get done in 2 total, and it ended up being about roughly 4.
Wow.
So it was, I was way off on that. And I learned that the second I put the first park together. I put the first park together, and then I put it on my bicycle, and I pedaled around, went up to Isle Royale and around the top half of Lake Michigan and came back. I'm like, this is going to take me forever. But once you start, I'm like, I didn't know what to do.
Yeah, you have to go through. You have to follow through. Here's a couple more questions. 847 said, did Mike see that national parks are now serving healthier food at their food stops? Do most of them serve food, and can you bring food in?
I didn't see that, but most parks do serve food. So they all have lodges, and basically the lodges do double duty. They'll have little diners or restaurants where you can order a regular meal. And that's good that they're serving healthy food. But yeah, and again, to save money, bringing a cooler is always a great way to do things, and picnic or grill or camp, whatever you're going to do, they definitely don't check your cars and make sure that you're not bringing food in.
Sure. 312 asks this, a very, very good question. What is the most underrated park? What is the most overrated park?
That is a good question. I should look at my book. I've got sections. I hope it matches up with what I say. I've got a bunch of lists with underrated and overrated parks. Underrated, there are a bunch of them. There's North Cascades in northern Washington. It's a really cool park. There are only, like, maybe 20,000 people go each year.
Oh, that's a low number. How come? What's going on there?
It's just kind of remote. It's so people from Seattle, they tend to go to Mount Rainier. I think Mount Rainier and Olympic National Park kind of draw the traffic, and North Cascades is forgotten about. And it's kind of a strange place as far as parks go, too. It's a national park complex where they join two recreation areas, and then the North Cascades National Park is a north and south unit. And it's a little confusing getting in. You actually can't even get to the north unit by road. South unit, you can get in by a dirt road. But it's a really cool place. Really big mountains, really great scenery, good paddling, good backcountry. And, all right, other underrated ones. Maybe Great Sand Dunes in Colorado is a really underrated one. Black Canyon also in Colorado is underrated.
Why underrated? What's going on? Why don't they get the dew?
The sand dunes is just really, they're people that'll like take a wakeboard and surf down the sand dunes, and a creek and spring comes along the sides. So it's basically like a beach in the middle of Colorado, like a bunch of sand too in the middle of Colorado, which you don't expect.
Wait, so when you're surfing down a sand dune, are you using like a standard surfboard, or how do you do that?
They're using kind of like a more of a wakeboard, a short,
like, or a boogie board.
Yeah, or I don't know what you call it, a wake skate, something like that.
Yeah.
And but they bring sleds too. They sled down it, and it's even fun. I just kind of leaped around, just bounded down the hills, and really, really neat, kind of like an anti-gravity feeling.
And overrated. What are we looking at? Overrated. What gets a lot of press that you just go, that's it? That's all they got?
I tend to think Yellowstone's overrated. Personally, it's everything's really neat, but Old Faithful, like I don't know how many times you can watch that thing erupt, and it's cool that they know when it's going to go off. It almost seems like it's plumbed, because they've got signs on the visitor centers like, be here at this such and such time and sit in the bleachers and watch Old Faithful go off.
Really? I didn't know they had it pinpointed like that.
Yeah, for the in a 10 to 20 minute range, they always have signs up and letting you know when it's going to go off.
What about Jellystone? Cool. Do you think, because Jellystone is just, all you see there is Yogi Bear and Boo Boo, and then that's all they have? That's not worth the trip, is it?
That's where you bring your picnic basket.
I know. There's trouble. I told you last time you were here that my wife and I bicycled through Acadia National Park in Maine, and you really get the feeling, and I know you've experienced this 1,000 times, but I'm not used to it. You can't quite place the time that you're in. I mean, we did it about 15 or 20 years ago, but you could have been in modern day. You could have been 100 years ago. You could have been 500 years ago. You just kind of lose all aspect of what time it is, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And Acadia is a neat one where they've got those carriage roads. So you're kind of it adds to the confusing time frame of where you're at if you warp backwards. But yeah, it is hard to figure out what's going on because you get horses running around some places with cowboys on them leading pack trips. So yeah, absolutely. And that's another thing. That's a good reason for families to go out to these places to see a different way of life.
No question about it. Well, what a great book. It's Your Guide to the National Parks. The author is Mike Oswald. Mike, a job well done. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you have a great summer.
Oh, thank you so much, Bill. It's always a pleasure.